The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. This is Richard Martin here from Singapore with your Friday diet of the Wake Up Call, coming to you on the 20th of May, 2011. Well, you know the old joke. Why is it called the American Dream? Answer, because you have to be asleep to believe it. Well, perhaps it is the greatest marketing slogan of all time, larger than life in the American Declaration, applied to an entire citizenry, the pursuit of happiness. In a recent article in Psychology Today, they talk about how over generations of prosperity and growth, the American dream has become an American expectation, a version of happiness achieved by entitlement and equation. Two fat incomes, the two-car garage, plus two master bathroom sinks, plus two-point-something kids equals one happy family. To be sure, the recession has deferred some of the dream. Still, one imagines that in time will be realized a formula for a satisfied adulthood once more. We'll land the job, catch the spouse, buy the house, have the kids. In short, we'll live the better life. But a raft of reports on well-being, including the World Values Survey and the General Social Survey of the National Opinion Register Center, suggest it's not better at all. We the people has grown continuously more depressed over the last half century. A recent analysis of the World Database of Happiness, covering the years 1946 to 2006, found rising happiness levels in 19 of 26 countries around the world. The United States was not one of them. As Andrew Oswald, who studies the intersection of economies and happiness at the University of Warwick in Britain, states, and I quote, "The USA has, in aggregate, apparently become more miserable over the last quarter century." End of quote. Oswald and many other behavioral researchers say much of America's discontent seems linked to the unrealistic expectations of the American dream. Surveys have discovered more depression and unhappiness in adults with kids than in those without. You spend more hours at the office than almost any workforce in the world to pay for the big suburban house, but in exchange you suffer a commute that makes you miserable and a social isolation that puts more pressure on home life than even a mansion can bear. In a 1966 essay in the Saturday Evening Post, Joan Didion pilloried those who had achieved the American dream. Quote, "They had achieved the bigger house on the better street and the familiar accoutrement of a family on its way up. And they were paying the familiar price for it." End of quote. Well, that price seems to have risen in recent years as if by inflation. And by investing so much well-being in America's little slice of suburbia to the exclusion of the greater community, may be pushing families up the path to an increasingly elusive summit. Americans cycle through relationships at exceptionally high rates. lower since the recession. Divorce rates in the United States are still the highest in the West, and staying together is often no better. The percentage of Americans unhappy in their marriages is a full 10 points higher today than it was in polls 30-odd years ago, according to the latest annual State of Our Unions report on family life, a joint publication from the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia and the Center for Marriage and Families at the Institute for American Values. The report cites the 2008 National Survey of Family Growth, which found that when asked whether, quote, marriage has not worked out for most people they know, end of quote, 37% of people agreed. A child born to unmarried cohabiting parents in Sweden has a better chance of living with both parents at 16 than a kid born to married parents in the United States. In studies that ask people to keep daily diaries of their well-being, psychologists have found that European parents report far more pleasurable experiences than their U.S. counterparts do. Of course, throughout the European Union, the state funds childcare, pediatric visits, lengthy maternity, and often paternity, and so on. Over half of Americans live not just in the suburbs, but in true sprawl. Suburbs were imagined to be more land, more choice, more freedom. Instead, America is stuck on the highway or striding through a parking lot that stretches from Walmart to the horizon. According to Andres Duany, co-author of Suburban Nation, sprawl is the collapse of suburbia, the portrayal of promise. And that's Andres Duany, the author of Suburbia, the Rise of Sprawl and the Decline of the American Dream. The disconnect between suburban expectation, the idea of building a family and a community in a tamed expanse of land, and the blighted reality of sprawl explains much of America's national dissatisfaction, says Duany. Add to that, he says, the loss of authentic connections that comes from the distinctly American notion of home ownership that plays a key part in fulfilling the dream. You purchase a private realm, your home, to replace a public sphere that no longer exists. Today's houses are, quote, fully equipped to compensate and mitigate the loss of the public realm, Duany says. 50 years ago, homes averaged 1,700 square feet. Now that figure is up to 2,700, and interior architecture in Chinese exists to mimic the urban world where few Americans dwell today. The double-height entry hall is the surrogate of the Taunton Square. The meeting room supplants the theater. The master suite practically exists as its own townhouse. Multiple dining areas further service America's separation from the outside world. The breakfast nook is the diner. The formal dining room is the special occasion white tablecloth restaurant. Even the kitchen island functions like a European tabac. If you had a public realm, Duany says, you wouldn't have to buy more house. Duany's own work in the new urbanist movement, planning walkable, mixed-use areas designed to recapture a sense of community, may be the best bet for a resurgence of the public realm. But even a semi-utopian like Duany has a hard time imagining how to reverse the course of American sprawl en masse. Of course, America has been rocketing towards this point for decades now. The growth of the interstate highway system in the 1950s and 60s accelerated the surge to the suburbs. The car, as Duany says, quote, has become a prosthetic device, end of quote. And so Americans spend their lives ferrying between cubicle and soccer practice with nary an hour to spare. Not only is all that overscheduling making them unhappy, but the actual commuting itself. In 2008, Swiss economists Alois Stüpfer and Bruno Frey discovered the so-called commuting paradox. While people gladly trade a longer daily commute for a bigger home in suburbs, Stüpfer and Frey found a direct link between long drives to work and low well-being. In fact, they reported that people who commute roughly 45 minutes each day have to earn 19% more a month than they already do to make the trip worthwhile. It's not just the bummer of getting to work. It's the reality of staying there. Americans have the longest work week in the developed world. In Norway and the Netherlands, workers clock in 1,400 hours per year. Americans, meanwhile, average 1,900 hours. In fact, Americans spend more time at the office than the citizens of any other industrialized country and all but two developing nations. Over time, the famed American slavish devotion to earning income detracts from pursuits that might reduce this misery, such as forging strong relationships. Kasser argues that a materialistic drive actually damages the ability to form personal bonds, causing such people to, quote, treat other people as objects to be manipulated rather than as unique individuals with their own desire, needs, and subjective experiences, end quote. In other words, the focus on accumulating things, the harder it becomes to drop these things and focus on people. It's a vicious circle. Overinvestment in the nuclear family and rigid ideas about how to shelter and school one's kids requires more time and work to pay for the needs of the family and extra estrangement from the world at large. That explains why mothers and fathers spent more time both at the office and with their children in 2009 than they did in 1975, according to the American Time Use Survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's a treadmill locked on a setting that never lets us catch our breath or consider how we started running so fast in the first place. And the more we strive to meet the expectations of the American dream, the increasingly elusive happiness becomes. This dream of arriving at some destination of deep fulfillment, a place where parenting will give profound joy and satisfaction, where the romance of partnership is eternal, where making home payment on the first of every month is a source of pride and not anxiety, is often no more than that, a dream. It may, in fact, be impossible to awaken from the current version, the American dream. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to call back because I understand there's really a lot of distortion, so if you will just hold one second, I'll be right back.
Progressive Radio Network. This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers.
This is a state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there. Or be square.
Come to the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, well, I'm sorry about that. It seems that the distortion is back. I'll have to look into this next week again. And I do apologize for the trouble. The trouble is not with PRN. The trouble is definitely at my end, and I will do what it takes to try to rectify the problem. Okay, let me, in the meantime, give you my information. I'm Richard Martin. And this is the wake-up call, and if you would like to call in to discuss some issue which is close to your heart, you may do so by calling our toll-free number at 888-874-4888. Now, I do encourage you to do this. I'm sure there's among listeners present, there are some of you with pressing questions that you would like to have answered or matters that you would like to discuss, you are very welcome to call in and we will deal with them immediately in real time. So once again, the toll-free number is 888-874-4888. Now, if you would like to send in your questions, my email is also possible and done by many people, and for that I would ask you please to write to rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. That's GFAWD.com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my personal direct line for if you wish to call in your personal conundrum and distinct problems that you may be experiencing, you may do that in private by calling my direct line at a Sarasota, Florida area code 941-441-1682. And that again is 941-441-1682. Okay, well, hopefully the reception is somewhat better, and what happens is if it goes bad, Matt, the engineer, will inform me, and I will just spend a couple of moments calling back and trying to secure a better line, but if I don't hear from him, I will assume that all is well. Okay, well now, ladies and gentlemen, some of you will be relieved that I haven't come at you recently with the usual regular spate of statistics that pepper my wake-up calls from time to time. Well, my friends, brace yourselves for the next round, because it's been a while, and as I keep saying, you absolutely have to know these things, and I very much doubt that there's another program on PRN where you can obtain them. Not that your hosts have any compunction about delivering them, I'm sure they don't. It's just that it's what they do to keep you entertained, but it is my lot to do so. So as it falls on my shoulders, I shall shrink from my responsibility. I tell you that the numbers are harrowing. They are very, very grim, and as I'm sure you all know, that you can be assured that the mainstream media will not do the job, so just so you know, the figures are on their way. Hopefully by Monday, we will have them together and I will bring them to you. In the meantime, let me see what I have here. I get an email from Masood Mahmoud, who says, "Hey Richard, the fake profits of the stock rallies are booming the IT consulting business. My boss says he can't hire software developers fast enough. I hope that the delusion continues for at least a few years till I become a senior developer. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. Your comments are much appreciated." Well, this email simply just came in just moments ago, so I must tell you that Mahmoud, it's all a lie, it's all a trick, and it's all wool which is being pulled over your eyes. In 2002, for the first 7 years, the government borrowed and spent 5% of GDP a year just to make it look as though the recession was over and that there was an economic recovery. there was no recovery, as we all know perfectly well. So what did they do? After the meltdown, they spent, for the last 2 years, 12%, over double what they had spent, 12% of GDP a year, to try to give the impression that there was an economic recovery. That hasn't worked either. Words failed me when it comes to this sentence, because really, when you're dealing with the economy, there are supposed to be people in positions of power, positions of knowledge, who have done economic studies, that are able to lead the way and make the necessary changes to the economy in order to deal with these kind of problems. But the problem really lies in the fact that in the universities, in the business schools, economics never deal with the kind of problems we have now. The textbooks don't contain any mention of them. I challenge anybody to go to a textbook and find out what is supposed to happen when banks melt down, sovereign countries go bankrupt together. It doesn't happen, because the purpose of economics is to show how good things are and how to make good things get better. And that's why you have a whole stream of economists out of business school who have simply no idea about what's happening right now. And they certainly don't have any idea how to deal with it. And that's why they spend all this money. They don't know what they're doing. And one of the most important things you need to know, ladies and gentlemen, is that they really do not know what they're doing. I've said this before, and it's very hard to believe. I mean, it's as though you were going to have a major operation and your surgeon had no idea what to do once he'd cut open your body. Just sort of, you know, poked around a little bit and pulled out something that he thought looked a little bit strange, and that might be it. So he sews your body back up together again, and you die 3 days later. I mean, basically, we're dealing with people, the blind leading the blind. When people like Bernanke throw money into the system in the way that they have, they truly have no idea whether it's going to work or not. You know, the fact that they set up in serious business and white shirts and talk on TV and assume positions of responsibility makes not the slightest bit of difference. They have no idea whether these things will work or not. None. And I'm not exaggerating. This is not a question of, oh, well, he doesn't really understand and he's just painting a grimmer picture because it sounds better. Not at all. I have to tell you that it is absolutely clear that these people who make decisions on behalf of entire countries in a situation such as we have today, which has no precedent and has nothing written about it in the textbooks, is nothing more than a grand experiment on the part of the powers that be. And because they're not particularly bright in the first place, that experiment is very, very unlikely to work. Well, housing starts came in substantially worse than expected this week, falling from March's 500,000 units to only 528 units in April. This is way off consensus guess of 70,000, and not a good thing, especially when put into the spring context, which is when we expect gains. Unbelievably, Econopray doesn't mention the southern storms as being a factor, and this is probably one time that they actually were, as you can see that the southern market was hit the hardest. Also, this number has become extremely volatile, with large monthly shifts that are greater than 10% moves, and also very large revisions. This is a red flag for me. It tells me that there is likely manipulation occurring and probably outright fraud. We know that the NAR has been caught red-handed in this regard. That's the National Association of Realtors. And so I wouldn't be surprised to learn that this report is being massaged as well. Note that starts at this level are less than half what they were. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a true depression. Industrial production was just released and also came in worse than expected for April. In March, it supposedly grew from an already woeful 77.4% to 76.9% went higher than expected. utilization rates that slow are sick, especially when it's been years now since the financial crisis began, and thus companies have had plenty of time to shed excess capacity. It tells me that the shedding is not over, and in the big picture, it's just another confirmatory piece to my debt saturation thesis. Now, only about a year and a half behind us, and those who pay attention finally air the piece on the corrupt actions of the banks regarding loan processing. This piece, of course, falls woefully short in its discussion of outright bank fraud. The setting up and the use of MERS isn't even mentioned. Still, even with much of the fraud missing, it's obvious that it's nothing but non-stop fraud 100% of the time. And the other thing that this piece leads you to believe something's changed, it hasn't. And what's not even being discussed is how the bank's fraud created an overpriced bubble for everyone. Everyone who lives in a home, be it rent or own, pays too much to live in that home because of the fraud perpetrated by the bankers. Let that sink in for a moment. This is far beyond simple paperwork fraud or simple lazy paper errors. The mess in Europe to me is just such a sad joke. The never-ending talk of bailouts, rejection of bailouts, debt limits, defaults, etc. Sad. It's sad that the people of the world have been enslaved by the debt pushers and that they are failing to break free from their trap. More information and news over there than you can shake a stick at. I wouldn't even attempt to cover it all because the bottom line is clear to me. That being that Europe is saturated with debt, the math is impossible. All attempts to force more debt or to restructure via longer loan terms is nothing but kicking the debt bubble down the road. Ladies and gentlemen, default is 100% going to happen and is in fact already in progress, devaluation of everyone's money. The situation in Fukushima is dire. Very high amounts of radiation have been found in areas of Tokyo. The Japanese are pretending that this radiation doesn't exist, and the government and TEPCO have been slow leaking the data. All the while, school children go to schools that are massively polluted with radiation. The reactors have melted down. The cores have obviously been breached. The phony clad and meant to placate the public just a few weeks ago has already completely fallen apart. Meanwhile, those reactors continue to spew radiation, and that radiation absolutely making its way around the planet while being ignored by all the world's governments, including America. Japanese officials admit that Unit Number 1 has suffered a complete and total meltdown and that the molten corium is not only laying on the bottom of the reactor but has exited the bottom and may very well likely be in the basement of the reactor building. It's also possible that it's beyond the concrete and that it's the world's first true China syndrome meltdown. What these reactors are doing to Japan is horrific, and the radiation continues to spread around the globe. How does America's president react? The other day he urged Japan's government to take steps to prevent a further decline in TEPCO stock. We've had a huge sausage sugar in the form of massive monetary printing in the United States. That money printing has masqueraded as growth, but also as productivity, because things that are measured in dollars will appear to grow, it's apparent growth, when the value of the dollar is being diluted with quantity. Thus, I expect that any attempt to wean the economy off the sugar will result in a pretty quick case of glucose crash, and thus the need to inject more figurative sugar for the addict, the economy rots from the inside out, just as a drug addict's teeth rot and fall out. Well, I hope, Mahmoud, that helped to answer your question somewhat, but I'm glad to know that you're in particular situation, but don't rest on your laurels, my friend. There's going to be trouble ahead. All right. And I believe we're still getting some distortion. We will take our break at this point, and Matt, I'll call right back, and we'll see if we can get lucky and get a line that sounds good. Okay, back in a moment.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kissed a smile upon her face.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
The most news anywhere on the internet. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, your number one source for everything progressive.
Okay, well, we're back, and this is another attempt to see if technology will allow us to do our job. So here's a quick recap of the nightmare that is our future, especially for those who have either never heard of the wake-up call before today or those who have just arrived from planet Mars. Surely by now we all know that the present situation is unsustainable, that we feel this need to go through the motions of phony so-called reforms and trimming the deficit as if another 1,000 pages of reforms will fix what's broken in the economy, or that trimming $50 billion from $1.7 trillion annual deficits will actually matter. In brief, here's the reality. The entire so-called prosperity of the past decade was a false prosperity, constructed entirely of money borrowed by the private sector based on the rising value of mansions and strip malls that made no sense except speculations based on the Federal Reserve's credit bubble policy and Wall Street's systemic financialization of that debt based on fraud and misrepresentation of risk. The private sector borrowed and spent an extra $1 trillion a year in the boom years, the bubble decade. This debt-based stimulus vanished with the implosion of Wall Street's fraud machine, you know, the CDOs, mortgage-backed securities, etc., and the collapse of bubble-era housing valuations. As overleveraged households and businesses found they could no longer borrow $1 trillion extra a year to spend, the federal government stepped in and borrowed and spent $1 trillion a year to replace the private borrowing which had dried up. This $1 trillion is incredibly obvious. Federal spending rose by exactly $1 trillion from 2007-2010, while revenues fell by $400 billion. And we can break this down into three categories. Spending, 2007, $2.72 trillion. 2010, $3.72 trillion. Revenues, 2007, $2.56 trillion. 2010, $2.16 trillion. Deficit, 2007, $160 billion, 2010, $1.56 trillion. This is how you get an annual structural deficit of $1.5 trillion, ladies and gentlemen. The sum will never go down. It will only go up, as the estimated deficits for 2011 and 2012 show. 2011, $1.5 trillion estimated. 2012, $1.6 trillion estimated. This doesn't even count off-budget borrowing for bailing out our moral hazard twins, Penny Mae and Freddie Mac, and for additional war expenses. Add off-budget borrowing and the structural deficit is 12.5% of GDP. This is only one comparable period of federal borrowing and deficit spending. World War II, which ended in less than 4 years, December 1941 to August 1945. So here we are with the United States borrowing 12% of GDP every year for 4 years with no end in sight. All that's being done is propping up the status quo. The private economy cannot support an additional $1 trillion in borrowing and spending every year. Housing assets and household earnings continue to decline, even as basic household expenses for energy, food, education, and healthcare continue to rise. Housing is still overvalued, a reality that will become abundantly clear once interest rates begin their inevitable rise. Household earnings will continue to stagnate or decline. Households cannot borrow an extra $1 trillion a year, and that will not change in the foreseeable future. This is not the warm and fuzzy stagnation of the 1970s, when wages and interest income rose along with prices. In this Fed-engineered stagflation, wages remain flat to down, and savers earn nothing for their capital, while taxes and costs for essentials steadily rise. The primary asset for two-thirds of the nation's households, housing, continues to fall. The rising stock market increases the wealth of the 10% of households, but does little to nothing for the bottom 90%. The Fed's policy of top-down wealth effect is widening an already unprecedented gap between the haves and the have-nots in the nation. This widening divide is no secret. It is simply another feature of America's suspended animation. Simply put, the present set of policies is leading directly to household and national insolvency. Well, changing the subject a little bit here, Defying Hitler is a mesmerizing memoir written by the German journalist Sebastian Haffner, a pseudonym for Raimund Pretzel, shortly after he emigrated from Germany to England with his Jewish wife in 1938. In it, Hafner explores a question similar to one that has haunted me since 9/11. He examines how a highly cultured and civilized nation could slip so quickly into the barbaric totalitarianism of Nazi rule. I would ask, how could America, a nation with deep roots in individual freedom, so quickly slide into a police state? Such an abrupt societal change requires the acceptance or acquiescence of a majority of its people. Key to the explanation from Nazi Germany and current America is the steady and profound reshaping of society's institutions. From the school system to law enforcement, from the courts to the hospitals. The institutions began to express a different vision of society. For example, instead of expressing the rule of law and due process protections, the courts came to embody the opposite. Since 9/11, a sea change in the institutions of America has moved the country ever further away from individual freedom and towards state control. Perhaps no institutional change embodies the shift more clearly than the militarization of law enforcement at all levels. The average individual is now treated as a criminal suspect in airports, at the entrance of public buildings, in the ever-increasing requirement for ID, and during the exercise of so-called guaranteed rights, such as peaceful assembly and bearing arms. Law enforcement now treats the public almost as enemy combatants. Over time, the behavior encouraged by institutions becomes the expression of character traits not only of individuals, but also of the society itself. And so a society acquires a closed rather than an open air. It becomes desensitized to brutality, afraid of dissent, and hostile to the other. Rewarded by the authorities, people even come to view spying on their neighbors as a civic duty. This explains how a society becomes a total state. It doesn't explain why. Why do cultured Germans or rugged Americans stand by and watch the emergence of totalitarianism? A common explanation is that they do not notice. Unless they're steeped in history, those accustomed to liberty or civility can be blithely unaware of the importance of mechanisms like due process. It is those who lived without such legal niceties who knew full well that the likes of habeas corpus are protections upon which life or death of innocent people will hinge. Many of those who do notice refuse to believe their freedom will deteriorate beyond a certain point. In Defying Hitler, Hafner notes how this educated associates constantly ridiculed the Nazis as a passing phase. I hear much the same from people in the United States who dismiss the rise of totalitarian with the words, "But this is America. It cannot happen here." Still others who notice are convinced by the fear tactics of authorities that surrendering rights is necessary to ensure their continued comfort and safety. In Germany, the crisis exploited was the devastation caused by the punitive terms of the post-World War I Treaty of Versailles. The rise of socialism and the presence of the other, especially Jews, were used both to stir anger against a common enemy and to scare people into subservience. In America, the slow crisis is the war against terror conducted in the wake of 9/11. Islamic extremism and anyone who seeks to cross the border are a threat. Hafner also speaks of the automatic continuation of ordinary life that hindered any lively, forceful reaction against the horror of Hitler. This may be true of many Americans as well, who see the erosion of freedom on a daily basis. Nevertheless, because they wake up in their own homes, eat the same cereal for breakfast, work at the same boring job to which they drive down the same familiar streets, they have a sense that everything is always has been. The fact that the legal structure, political protections, and other institutions that guaranteed their freedoms are gone, is nowhere near as real to them as are their daily routines. In a 2002 review of Defying Hitler, Stephen Martinovich commented, and I quote, "The process of statism was so slow that one could almost understand how one day Germans walked the street as members of a shaky democracy and the next were prisoners. Between those 2 days, the Germany Hafner grew up in, both figuratively and literally, disappeared." Sadly, America is disappearing day by day. Yet more grist for the emigration mill, my dear listeners, I'm afraid. Well, I'm not one to particularly comment on the ugly issues of the day, as they do not pertain to the world of finance, but in reference to the nasty situation that took place in the Sofitel Hotel the other day in New York City, I came across what I thought was an interesting comment on the trials and travails of Dominic Strauss-Kahn and Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was by Jonah Lehrer, who has this to say about power. "The news abounds with stories of powerful men behaving badly. It's a depressing yet predictable spectacle. Those in positions of power can't help but help themselves to the help. They scream at underlings and have sex with the secretaries, assault hotel maids, or at least are accused of such, and sleep with the nanny. The question, of course, is what motivates this awful behavior? Why does power corrupt? Psychologists refer to this as the paradox of power. The very traits that helped leaders accumulate control in the first place all but disappear once they rise to power. Instead of being polite, honest, and outgoing, they become impulsive, reckless, and rude. According to psychologists, one of the main problems with authority is that it makes us less sympathetic to the concerns and emotions of others. For instance, several studies have found that people in positions of authority are more likely to rely on stereotypes and generalizations when judging other people. They also spend much less time making eye contact, at least when a person without power is talking. Consider a recent experiment led by Adam Galinsky, a psychologist at Northwestern University. Galinsky and colleagues began by asking subjects to either describe an experience in which they had lots of power or a time when they felt utterly powerless. Then the psychologists asked the subjects to draw the letter E on their foreheads. Those primed with feelings of power were much more likely to draw the letter backwards, at least when seen by another person. Galinsky et al. Argue that this effect is triggered by the myopia of power, which makes it much harder to imagine the world from the perspective of someone else. We draw the letter backwards because we don't care about the viewpoint of others. We couldn't care less what the maid thinks. But here's the catch. We still think we do care, at least in the abstract. That's because power quickly turns us into hypocrites. In a 2009 study, Galinsky asked subjects to think about either experience of power or powerlessness. The students were then divided into two groups. The first group was told to rate on the 9-point scale the moral seriousness of misreporting travel expenses at work. The second group was asked to participate in a game of dice, in which the results of the dice determined the number of lottery tickets each student received. A higher roll led to more tickets. Participants in the high power group considered the misreporting of travel expenses to be a significantly worse offense. However, the game of dice produced a completely contradictory result. In this instance, people in the high power group reported, on average, a statistically improbable result with an average dice score that was 20% above that expected by random choice. The powerless group, in contrast, reported only slightly elevated dice results. This strongly suggests that they were lying about their actual scores, fudging the numbers to get a few extra tickets. Although most people almost always know the right thing to do, cheating is wrong, their sense of power makes it easier to rationalize away the ethical lapse. For instance, when the psychologists asked the subjects, in both low and higher power conditions, how they would judge an individual who drove too fast when late for an appointment, people in the high power group consistently said it was worse when others committed those crimes than when they did themselves. In other words, the feeling of eminence led people to conclude that they had a good reason for speeding, they're important people with important things to do, but that everyone else should follow the posted signs. But perhaps you're not convinced by these clever lab experiments performed mostly on undergrads. Perhaps you think that the paradigms smack of artifice. One of my favorite studies of power corrupting comes from Deborah Grünfeld, a psychologist at the Stanford Business School. She was interested in how positions of power altered our reasoning process. After analyzing more than 1,000 decisions handed down by the United States Supreme Court between 1953 and 1993, Grünfeld found that as justices gained power of the court or became part of a majority coalition, their written opinions tended to become less complex and nuanced. They considered fewer perspectives and possible outcomes. The bad news, of course, is that the opinions written from the majority position are what actually become the law of the land. The larger lesson is Foucault had a point. The dynamics of power can profoundly influence how we think. When we climb the ladder of status, our inner arguments get warped and our natural sympathy for others is vanquished. Instead of fretting about the effects of our actions, we just go ahead and act. We deserve what we want. And how dare they resist? Don't they know who we are? Well, interesting, and perhaps somewhat pathetic. Well, Ilagi mocked Jean-Claude Juncker at an Automatic Earth article yesterday, simply entitled Reprofiling. Okay, kids, look at the blackboard now. We're going to learn a new word today. The word is reprofiling. Reprofiling is a term invented over the past few days by one or more negotiators at the table discussing how to hide the fact that Greece is disappearing into the Aegean Sea slowly but surely, a while longer. In normal days and circumstances, Greece would default on its debt. The parties holding that debt would reach a hard agreement to take losses on various percentages of their claims, and the next morning the sun would rise again, as it always has, over all 100,000 or so Greek islands. Not this time. This time Greece is part of the European Union and the Eurozone, and more importantly, the country owes its debts to financial institutions all across the globe that can't afford the losses any hard-fought agreements would force upon them. whether it's Wall Street banks or the German Landesbanken or French giants Paribas and Crédit Agricole, they're all tilting so close to the edge that any such loss recognitions might do them in. German banks alone have $28 billion in Greek debt on their books. That doesn't include any swaps. A haircut such as that, which would probably be required in a run-of-the-mill debt restructuring, might be in the vicinity of 50% or more, which would take 14 billion euros out of German banks' books, and many billions more out of other global banks. It would need to recapitalize, and some might not be able to do so. But that's not the worst part. Those same German banks carry 114.7 billion euros in Irish debt and 146.8 billion in Spanish debt. That's just the German bank. What British, French, Dutch, and Spanish banks hide in their vaults at 100 cents on the dollar or euro is easily an order of magnitude more. And that, my friends, is how we get to our word of the day, reprofiling. Well, I see exactly no beef. All I see is fluff. The public has been totally hypnotized with disinformation. Not one shred of evidence to support the bin Laden storyline. Sorry, but that video released last weekend was a joke. No one is investigating an obviously tampered birth certificate presented by the president, and meanwhile the truly important stories drop from everyone's attention, like the fact that there's another war brewing in Libya and simmering in Pakistan, and we're still ignoring the fallout from Fukushima. The business media is definitely all fluff. I watched a report that centered upon the question, was the investment the American public made in General Motors the best public investment ever? Gee, and I'm not even being led anywhere by the way they framed the question, am I? Of course they roll out the happy idiots that have no remorse at taking fluff money to shill a mindless storyline. Not one person even hinted what would have happened had they been allowed to fail, like the possibility that new companies would have been allowed to start up and bring truly innovative products to market. Alternatives are not allowed to be discussed when shilling is in progress. Just like people who see alternatives to the storyline being offered by the politicians are ridiculed in the press for having alternative opinions, or for even, heaven for Betsy, asking for proof of ridiculous assertions. It's stunning to me the whole wide acceptance of the storyline when it is accompanied by absolutely no proof and completely unbelievable assertions. In fact, I believe there are several assertions in the official storyline that are outright lies. A couple are even physical impossibilities, like the timeline presented to test the matter of faith, like religion. But I have to remain agnostic until convinced otherwise. Actually, I need more to disbelief evidence. If no reporter questions, for they know that if they do, they will have no job in order to feed their family and keep them in the lavish lifestyle to which they are accustomed. For those who feed the storyline, Kool-Aid are rewarded. For those who question it are passed off as whack jobs. President Obama, please take note. Well, you may have heard Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner threw a bomb at America's financial future on Tuesday night, saying he is, quote-unquote, certain another financial catastrophe is on the way and that there is no way of reaching agreement on the debt ceiling without increasing taxes on the wealthy. And he blamed a combination of timid politician and credit card debt-ridden Americans rather than Wall Street and the big banks for the financial woes that have beset the country over the past 3 years. Geithner was speaking at a New York screening of the HBO adaptation of Andrew Ross Sorkin's book, Too Big to Fail, which I believe is supposed to be very good. It came on the day that Senator Tom Coburn pulled out of the Gang of Six trying to find a bipartisan solution to the debt ceiling crisis. Geithner said, "I'm certain we will experience another crisis, but not when or what kind." Geithner said he didn't know when the next meltdown would happen, nor what kind it would be, during a question and answer session with Sorkin and Pulitzer Prize winning financial writer Liaquat Ahmed. But he warned it is on the way. Quote, "It will come again. There will be another storm, but it's not going to come for a while," end of quote. When Sorkin tried to press him for details, he added, "You will not know. It's not going to be possible for people to capture risk with perfect foresight and knowledge," end of quote. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Your Secretary of the Treasury is predicting a financial catastrophe. I have never seen that before. That is a first in my experience of politicians predicting Armageddon. So you have it. That's it. That's for you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, this is Richard Martin at the Wake Up Call wishing you a wonderful weekend. I will be back on Monday, same time, same place. Until then, bye-bye.